that H equals S, and that C and V don't matter. But we have to give Buddha and Epictetus credit for V, because Buddha prescribed the Eightfold Noble Path, including meditation and mindfulness, and Epictetus urged methods of thought to cultivate indifference, apatheia, to externals. So to test the wisdom of the sages properly, we must examine this hypothesis, H equals S plus V, where V equals voluntary or intentional activities that cultivate acceptance and weaken emotional attachments. If there are many conditions, C, that matter, and if there are a variety of voluntary activities beyond those aimed at non-attachment, then the happiness hypothesis of Buddha and Epictetus is wrong, and people would be poorly advised simply to look within. It turns out that there really are some external conditions, C, that matter. There are some changes you can make in your life that are not fully subject to the adaptation principle, and that might make you lastingly happier. It may be worth striving to achieve them. Noise. When I lived in Philadelphia, I learned a valuable lesson about real estate. If you must buy a house on a busy street, don't buy one within 30 yards of a traffic light. Every 95 seconds, I had to listen to 42 seconds of several people's musical selections, followed by 12 seconds of engines revving, with an impatient honk thrown in once every 15 cycles. I never got used to it, and when my wife and I were looking for a house in Charlottesville, I told our agent that if a Victorian mansion were being given away on a busy street, I would not take it. Research shows that people who must adapt to new and chronic sources of noise, such as when a new highway is built, never fully adapt, and even studies that find some adaptation still find evidence of impairment on cognitive tasks. Noise, especially noise that is variable or intermittent, interferes with concentration and increases stress. It's worth striving to remove sources of noise in your life. Commuting. Many people choose to move farther away from their jobs in search of a larger house. But although people quickly adapt to having more space, they don't fully adapt to the longer commute, particularly if it involves driving in heavy traffic. Even after years of commuting, those whose commutes are traffic-filled still arrive at work with higher levels of stress hormones. Driving under ideal conditions is, however, often enjoyable and relaxing. It's worth striving to improve your commute. Lack of control. One of the active ingredients of noise and traffic, the aspect that helps them get under your skin, is that you can't control them. In one classic study, David Glass and Jerome Singer exposed people to loud bursts of random noise. Subjects in one group were told they could terminate the noise by pressing a button, but they were asked not to press the button unless it was absolutely necessary. None of these subjects pressed the button, yet the belief that they had some form of control made the noise less distressing to them. In the second part of the experiment, the subjects who thought they had control were more persistent when working on difficult puzzles, but the subjects who had experienced noise without control gave up more easily. In another famous study, Ellen Langer and Judith Rodin gave benefits to residents on two floors of a nursing home. For example, plants in their rooms and a movie screening one night a week. But on one floor, these benefits came with a sense of control. The residents were allowed to choose which plants they wanted, and they were responsible for watering them. They were allowed to choose as a group which night would be movie night. On the other floor, the same benefits were simply doled out. The nurses chose the plants and watered them. The nurses decided which night was movie night. This small manipulation had big effects. On the floor with increased control, residents were happier, more active, and more alert, as rated by the nurses, not just by the residents. And these benefits were still visible 18 months later. Most amazingly, at the 18-month follow-up, residents of the floor given control had better health and half as many deaths, 15% versus 30%. In a review paper that Rodin and I wrote, we concluded that changing an institution's environment to increase the sense of control among its workers, students, patients, or other users was one of the most effective possible ways to increase their sense of engagement, energy, and happiness. Shame. Overall, attractive people are not happier than unattractive ones. Yet, surprisingly, some improvements in a person's appearance do lead to lasting increases in happiness. People who undergo plastic surgery report, on average, high levels of satisfaction with the process, and they even report increases in the quality of their lives and decreases in psychiatric symptoms, such as depression and anxiety, in the years after the operation. The biggest gains were reported for breast surgery, both enlargement and reduction. I think the way to understand the long-lasting effects of such seemingly shallow changes is to think about the power of shame in everyday life. Young women whose breasts are much larger or smaller than their ideal often report feeling self-consciousness every day about their bodies. Many adjust their posture or their wardrobe in an attempt to hide what they see as a personal deficiency. Being freed from such a daily burden may lead to a lasting increase in self-confidence and well-being. Relationships. The condition that is usually said to trump all others in importance is the strength and number of a person's relationships. Good relationships make people happy, and happy people enjoy more and better relationships than unhappy people. This effect is so important and interesting that it gets its own chapter. The next one. For now, I'll just mention that conflicts in relationships, having an annoying office mate or roommate, or having chronic conflict with your spouse, is one of the surest ways to reduce your happiness. You never adapt to interpersonal conflict. It damages every day, even days when you don't see the other person but ruminate about the conflict nonetheless. There are many other ways in which you can increase your happiness by getting the conditions of your life right, particularly in relationships, work, and the degree of control you have over stressors. So in the happiness formula, C is real and some externals matter. Some things are worth striving for, and positive psychology can help identify them. Of course, Buddha would adapt fully to noise, traffic, lack of control, and bodily deficiencies, but it has always been difficult, even in ancient India, for real people to become like Buddha. In the modern Western world, it is even harder to follow Buddha's path of non-doing and non-striving. Some of our poets and writers, in fact, urge us to forswear that path and embrace action wholeheartedly. It is vain to say that human beings ought to be satisfied with tranquility. They must have action, and they will make it if they cannot find it. Charlotte Bronte, 1847. Finding flow. Not all action, however, will work. Chasing after wealth and prestige, for example, will usually backfire. People who report the greatest interest in attaining money, fame, or beauty are consistently found to be less happy and even less healthy than those who pursue less materialistic goals. So what is the right kind of activity? What is V in the happiness formula? The tool that helped psychologists answer that question is the experience sampling method, invented by Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, the Hungarian-born co-founder of positive psychology. In Csikszentmihalyi's studies, people carry with them a pager that beeps several times a day. At each beep, the subject pulls out a small notebook and records what she is doing at that moment and how much she is enjoying it. Through this beeping of thousands of people tens of thousands of times, Csikszentmihalyi found out what people really enjoy doing, not just what they remember having enjoyed. He discovered that there are two different kinds of enjoyment. One is physical or bodily pleasure. At mealtimes, people report the highest levels of happiness on average. People really enjoy eating, especially in the company of others, and they hate to be interrupted by telephone calls, and perhaps Csikszentmihalyi's beeps, during meals, or, worst of all, during sex. But you can't enjoy physical pleasure all day long. By their very nature, food and sex satiate. To continue eating or having sex beyond a certain level of satisfaction can lead to disgust. Csikszentmihalyi's big discovery is that there is a state many people value even more than chocolate after sex. It is the state of total immersion in a task that is challenging yet closely matched to one's abilities. It is what people sometimes call being in the zone. Csikszentmihalyi called it flow because it often feels like effortless movement. Flow happens and you go with it. Flow often occurs during physical movement, skiing, driving fast on a curvy country road, or playing team sports. Flow is aided by music or by the action of other people, both of which provide a temporal structure for one's own behavior. For example, singing in a choir, dancing, or just having an intense conversation with a friend. And flow can happen during solitary creative activities, such as painting, writing, or photography. The keys to flow. There's a clear challenge that fully engages your attention. You have the skills to meet the challenge, and you get immediate feedback about how you are doing at each step, the progress principle. You get flash after flash of positive feeling with each turn negotiated, each high note correctly sung, or each brushstroke that falls into the right place. In the flow experience, elephant and rider are in perfect harmony. The elephant, automatic processes, is doing most of the work, running smoothly through the forest, while the rider, conscious thought, is completely absorbed in looking out for problems and opportunities, helping wherever he can. Drawing on Csikszentmihalyi's work, Seligman proposes a fundamental distinction between pleasures and gratifications. Pleasures are delights that have clear sensory and strong emotional components, such as may be derived from food, sex, back rubs, and cool breezes. Gratifications are activities that engage you fully, draw on your strengths, and allow you to lose self-consciousness. Gratifications can lead to flow. Seligman proposes that V, voluntary activities, is largely a matter of arranging your day and your environment to increase both pleasures and gratifications. Pleasures must be spaced to maintain their potency. Eating a quart of ice cream in an afternoon or listening to a new CD 10 times in a row are good ways to overdose and deaden yourself to future pleasure. Here's where the rider has an important role to play. Because the elephant has a tendency to overindulge, the rider needs to encourage it to get up and move on to another activity. Pleasures should be both savored and varied. The French know how to do this. They eat many fatty foods, yet they end up thinner and healthier than Americans. And they derive a great deal more pleasure from their food by eating slowly and paying more attention to the food as they eat it. Because they savor, they ultimately eat less. Americans, in contrast, shovel enormous servings of high-fat and high-carbohydrate food into their mouths while doing other things. The French also vary their pleasure by serving many small courses. Americans are seduced by restaurants that serve large portions. Variety is the spice of life because it is the natural enemy of adaptation. Supersizing portions, on the other hand, maximizes adaptation. Epicurus, one of the few ancient philosophers to embrace sensual pleasure, endorsed the French way when he said that the wise man chooses not the greatest quantity of food, but the most tasty. One reason for the widespread philosophical wariness of sensual pleasure is that it gives no lasting benefit. Pleasure feels good in the moment, but sensual memories fade quickly, and the person is no wiser or stronger afterwards. Even worse, pleasure beckons people back for more, away from activities that might be better for them in the long run. But gratifications are different. Gratifications ask more of us. They challenge us and make us extend ourselves. Gratifications often come from accomplishing something, learning something, or improving something. When we enter a state of flow, hard work becomes effortless. We want to keep exerting ourselves, honing our skills, using our strengths. Seligman suggests that the key to finding your own gratifications is to know your own strengths. One of the big accomplishments of positive psychology has been the development of a catalog of strengths. You can find out your strengths by taking an online test at www.authentichappiness.org. Recently, I asked the 350 students in my introductory psychology class to take the strengths test, and then, a week later, to engage in 4 activities over a few days. One of the activities was to indulge the senses, as by taking a break for ice cream in the middle of the afternoon, and then savoring the ice cream. This activity was the most enjoyable at the time, but, like all pleasures, it faded quickly. The other 3 activities were potential gratifications. Attend a lecture or class that you don't normally go to. Perform an act of kindness for a friend who could use some cheering up. And write down the reasons you are grateful to someone and later call or visit that person to express your gratitude. The least enjoyable of the 4 activities was going to a lecture, except for those whose strengths included curiosity and love of learning. They got a lot more out of it. The big finding was that people experienced longer-lasting improvements in mood from the kindness and gratitude activities than from those in which they indulged themselves. Even though people were most nervous about doing the kindness and gratitude activities, which required them to violate social norms and risk embarrassment, once they actually did the activities, they felt better for the rest of the day. Many students even said their good feelings continued on into the next day, which nobody said about eating ice cream. Furthermore, these benefits were most pronounced for those whose strengths included kindness and gratitude. So V, voluntary activity, is real, and it's not just about detachment. You can increase your happiness if you use your strengths, particularly in the service of strengthening connections, helping friends, expressing gratitude to benefactors. Performing a random act of kindness every day could get tedious, but if you know your strengths and draw up a list of 5 activities that engage them, you can surely add at least 1 gratification to every day. Studies that have assigned people to perform a random act of kindness every week or to count their blessings regularly for several weeks find small but sustained increases in happiness. So take the initiative. Choose your own gratifying activities, do them regularly, but not to the point of tedium, and raise your overall level of happiness. Misguided pursuits. An axiom of economics is that people pursue their interests more or less rationally, and that's what makes markets work. Adam Smith's invisible hand of self-interest. But in the 1980s, a few economists began studying psychology and messing up the prevailing models. Leading the way was the Cornell economist Robert Frank, whose 1987 book Passions Within Reason analyzed some of the things people do that just don't fit into economic models of pure self-interest, such as tipping in restaurants when far from home, seeking costly revenge, and staying loyal to friends and spouses when better opportunities come along. Frank argued that these behaviors make sense only as products of moral emotions, such as love, shame, vengeance, or guilt, and these moral emotions make sense only as products of evolution. Evolution seems to have made us strategically irrational at times for our own good. For example, a person who gets angry when cheated and who will pursue vengeance regardless of the cost earns a reputation that discourages would-be cheaters. A person who pursued vengeance only when the benefits outweighed the costs could be cheated with impunity in many situations. In his more recent book, Luxury Fever, Frank used the same approach to understand another kind of irrationality, the vigor with which people pursue many goals that work against their own happiness. Frank begins with the question of why, as nations rise in wealth, their citizens become no happier, and he considers the possibility that once basic needs are met, money simply cannot buy additional happiness. After a careful review of the evidence, however, Frank concludes that those who think money can't buy happiness just don't know where to shop. Some purchases are much less subject to the adaptation principle. Frank wants to know why people are so devoted to spending money on luxuries and other goods, to which they adapt completely, rather than on things that would make them lastingly happier. For example, people would be happier and healthier if they took more time off and spent it with their family and friends. Yet America has long been headed in the opposite direction. People would be happier if they reduced their commuting time, even if it meant living in smaller houses, Yet American trends are toward ever larger houses and ever longer commutes. People would be happier and healthier if they took longer vacations, even if it meant earning less. Yet vacation times are shrinking in the United States and in Europe as well. People would be happier and in the long run wealthier if they bought basic, functional appliances, automobiles, and wristwatches, and invested the money they saved for future consumption. Yet, Americans in particular spend almost everything they have, and sometimes more, on goods for present consumption, often paying a large premium for designer names and superfluous features. Frank's explanation is simple. Conspicuous and inconspicuous consumption follow different psychological rules. Conspicuous consumption refers to things that are visible to others and that are taken as markers of a person's relative success. These goods are subject to a kind of arms race, where their value comes not so much from their objective properties as from the statement they make about their owner. When everyone wore Timex watches, the first person in the office to buy a Rolex stood out. When everyone moved up to Rolex, it took a $20,000 Patek Philippe to achieve high status, and a Rolex no longer gave as much satisfaction. Conspicuous consumption is a zero-sum game. Each person's move up devalues the possessions of others. Furthermore, it's difficult to persuade an entire group or subculture to ratchet down, even though everyone would be better off, on average, if they all went back to simple watches. Inconspicuous consumption, on the other hand, refers to goods and activities that are valued for themselves, that are usually consumed more privately, and that are not bought for the purpose of achieving status. Because Americans, at least, gain no prestige from taking the longest vacations or having the shortest commutes, these inconspicuous consumables are not subject to an arms race. Just try this thought experiment. Which job would you rather have? One in which you earned $90,000 a year and your coworkers earned on average $70,000? Or one in which you earned $100,000, but your coworkers earned on average $150,000? Many people choose the first job, thereby revealing that relative position is worth at least $10,000 to them. Now try this one. Would you rather work for a company that gave you 2 weeks of vacation a year, but other employees were given, on average, only one? Or would you prefer a company that gave you 4 weeks of vacation a year, but other employees were given, on average, six? The great majority of people choose the longer absolute time. Time off is inconspicuous consumption. Although people can easily turn a vacation into conspicuous consumption by spending vast amounts of money to impress others instead of using the time to rejuvenate themselves. Frank's conclusions are bolstered by recent research on the benefits of doing versus having. The psychologists Leif Van Boven and Tom Gilovich asked people to think back to a time when they spent more than $100 with the intention of increasing their happiness and enjoyment. One group of subjects was asked to pick a material possession. The other was asked to pick an experience or activity they had paid for. After describing their purchases, subjects were asked to fill out a questionnaire. Those who described buying an experience, such as a ski trip, a concert, or a great meal, were happier when thinking about their purchase, and thought that their money was better spent than those who described buying a material object, such as clothing, jewelry, or electronics. After conducting several variations of this experiment with similar findings each time, Van Boven and Gilovich concluded that experiences give more happiness, in part because they have greater social value. Most activities that cost more than $100 are things we do with other people. But expensive material possessions are often purchased in part to impress other people. Activities connect us to others. Objects often separate us. So, now you know where to shop. Stop trying to keep up with the Joneses. Stop wasting your money on conspicuous consumption. As a first step, work less, earn less, accumulate less, and consume more family time, vacations, and other enjoyable activities. The Chinese sage Lao Tzu warned people to make their own choices and not pursue the material objects everyone else was pursuing. Racing and hunting madden the mind. Precious things lead one astray. Therefore the sage is guided by what he feels and not by what he sees. He lets go of that and chooses this. Unfortunately, letting go of one thing and choosing another is difficult if the elephant wraps his trunk around the precious thing and refuses to let go. The elephant was shaped by natural selection to win at the game of life, and part of its strategy is to impress others, gain their admiration, and rise in relative rank. The elephant cares about prestige, not happiness, and it looks eternally to others to figure out what is prestigious. The elephant will pursue its evolutionary goals even when greater happiness can be found elsewhere. If everyone is chasing the same limited amount of prestige, then all are stuck in a zero-sum game. An eternal arms race, a world in which rising wealth does not bring rising happiness. The pursuit of luxury goods is a happiness trap. It is a dead end that people race toward in the mistaken belief that it will make them happy. Modern life has many other traps. Here's some bait. Of the following words, pick the one that is most appealing to you. Constraint, limit, barrier, choice. Odds are you chose choice, because the first three gave you a flash of negative effect. Remember the Leica-meter. Choice and its frequent associate freedom are unquestioned goods of modern life. Most people would rather shop at a supermarket that stocks 10 items in each food category than a small store that stocks just 2. Most people would prefer to invest their retirement savings through a company that offers 40 funds than one that offers 4. Yet, when people are actually given a larger array of choices, for example, an assortment of 30 rather than 6 gourmet chocolates from which to choose, they are less likely to make a choice, and if they do, they are less satisfied with it. The more choices there are, the more you expect to find a perfect fit. Yet, at the same time, the larger the array, the less likely it becomes that you picked the best item. You leave the store less confident in your choice, more likely to feel regret, and more likely to think about the options you didn't choose. If you can avoid making a choice, you are more likely to do so. The psychologist Barry Schwartz calls this the paradox of choice. We value choice and put ourselves in situations of choice, even though choice often undercuts our happiness. But Schwartz and his colleagues find that the paradox mostly applies to people they call maximizers, those who habitually try to evaluate all the options, seek out more information, and make the best choice, or maximize their utility, as economists would say. Other people, satisficers, are more laid back about choice. They evaluate an array of options until they find one that is good enough, and then they stop looking. Satisficers are not hurt by a surfeit of options. Maximizers end up making slightly better decisions than satisficers, on average. All that worry and information gathering does help. But they are less happy with their decisions, and they are more inclined to depression and anxiety. In one clever study, maximizers and satisficers were asked to solve anagrams while sitting next to another subject, really a co-experimenter, who was solving them either much faster or much slower. Satisficers were relatively unfazed by the experience. Their ratings of their own ability and of how much they enjoyed the study were barely affected by what the other subject did. But maximizers were thrown for a loop when the other subject was faster than they were. They later reported lower estimates of their own abilities and higher levels of negative emotions. Being paired with a slower peer didn't have much effect. Another instance of negative events being stronger than positive. The point here is that maximizers engage in more social comparison and are therefore more easily drawn into conspicuous consumption. Paradoxically, maximizers get less pleasure per dollar they spend. Modern life is full of traps. Some of these traps are set by marketers and advertisers who know just what the elephant wants, and it isn't happiness. The Happiness Hypothesis Reconsidered. When I began writing this book, I thought that Buddha would be a strong contender for the Best Psychologist of the Last 3,000 Years Award. To me, his diagnosis of the futility of striving felt so right, his promise of tranquility so alluring. But in doing research for the book, I began to think that Buddhism might be based on an overreaction, perhaps even an error. According to legend, Buddha was the son of a king in northern India. When he was born as Siddhartha Gautama, the king heard a prophecy that his son was destined to leave, to go into the forest and turn his back on the kingdom. So as the boy grew into adulthood, his father tried to tie him down with sensual pleasures and hide from him anything that might disturb his mind. The young prince was married to a beautiful princess and raised on the upper floors of the palace, surrounded by a harem of other beautiful women. But he grew bored, the adaptation principle, and curious about the world outside. Eventually, he prevailed upon his father to let him go for a chariot ride. On the morning of the ride, the king ordered that all people who were old, sick, or crippled were to retreat indoors. Yet one old man remained on the road, and the prince saw him. The prince asked his chariot driver to explain the odd-looking creature, and the driver told him that everyone grows old. Stunned, the young prince returned to his palace. On the next day's excursion, he saw a sick man, his body hobbled by disease. More explanation, more retreating to the palace. On the third day, the prince saw a corpse being carried through the streets. This was the last straw. Upon discovering that old age, disease, and death are the destiny of all people, the prince cried, "Turn back the chariot! This is no time or place for pleasure excursions. How could an intelligent person pay no heed at a time of disaster when he knows of his impending destruction?" The prince then left his wife, his harem, and, as prophesied, his royal future. He went into the forest and began his journey to enlightenment. After his enlightenment, Buddha, the awakened one, preached that life is suffering, and that the only way to escape this suffering is by breaking the attachments that bind us to pleasure, achievement, reputation, and life. But what would have happened if the young prince had actually descended from his gilded chariot and talked to the people he assumed were so miserable? What if he had interviewed the poor, the elderly, the crippled, and the sick? One of the most adventurous young psychologists, Robert Biswas Diener, son of the happiness pioneer Ed Diener, has done just that. He has traveled the world interviewing people about their lives and how satisfied they are with them. Wherever he goes, from Greenland to Kenya to California, he finds that most people, with the exception of homeless people, are more satisfied than dissatisfied with their lives. He even interviewed sex workers in the slums of Calcutta, forced by poverty to sell their bodies and sacrifice their futures to disease. Although these women were substantially less satisfied with their lives than was a comparison group of college students in Calcutta, they still, on average, rated their satisfaction with each of 12 specific aspects of their lives as more satisfied than dissatisfied, or else as neutral, neither satisfied nor dissatisfied. Yes, they suffered privations that seemed to us in the West unbearable, but they also had close friends with whom they spent much of their time, and most of them stayed in touch with their families. Biswas Diener concludes that while the poor of Calcutta do not lead enviable lives, they do lead meaningful lives. They capitalize on the non-material resources available to them and find satisfaction in many areas of their lives. Like quadriplegics, the elderly, or any other class of people the young Buddha might have pitied, the lives of these prostitutes are much better from the inside than they seem from the outside. Another reason for Buddha's emphasis on detachment may have been the turbulent times he lived in. Kings and city-states were making war, and people's lives and fortunes could be burned up overnight. When life is unpredictable and dangerous, as it was for the Stoic philosophers, living under capricious Roman emperors, it might be foolish to seek happiness by controlling one's external world. But now it is not. People living in wealthy democracies can set long-term goals and expect to meet them. We are immunized against disease, sheltered from storms, and insured against fire, theft, and collision. For the first time in human history, Most people in wealthy countries will live past the age of 70 and will not see any of their children die before them. Although all of us will get unwanted surprises along the way, we'll adapt and cope with nearly all of them, and many of us will believe we are better off for having suffered. So to cut off all attachments, to shun the pleasures of sensuality and triumph, in an effort to escape the pains of loss and defeat, this now strikes me as an inappropriate response to the inevitable presence of some suffering in every life. Many Western thinkers have looked at the same afflictions as Buddha, sickness, aging, and mortality, and come to a very different conclusion from his. Through passionate attachments to people, goals, and pleasures, life must be lived to the fullest. I once heard a talk by the philosopher Robert Solomon, who directly challenged the philosophy of non-attachment as an affront to human nature. The life of cerebral reflection and emotional indifference, apatheia, advocated by many Greek and Roman philosophers, and that of calm non-striving advocated by Buddha, are lives designed to avoid passion, and a life without passion is not a human life. Yes, attachments bring pain, but they also bring our greatest joys, and there is value in the very variation that the philosophers are trying to avoid. I was stunned to hear a philosopher reject so much of ancient philosophy, but I was also inspired in a way that I had never been as an undergraduate student of philosophy. I walked out of the lecture hall feeling that I wanted to do something then and there to embrace life. Solomon's message was unorthodox in philosophy, but it is common in the work of romantic poets, novelists, and nature writers. We do not live but a quarter part of our life. Why do we not let on the flood, raise the gates, and set our wheels in motion? He that hath ears to hear, let him hear. Employ your senses. Henry David Thoreau, 1851. Even a future justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, a body devoted to reason, issued this opinion. I think that, as life is action and passion, it is required of a man that he should share the passion and action of his time at peril of being judged not to have lived. Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., 1884. Buddha, Lao Tzu, and other sages of the East discovered a path to peace and tranquility, the path of letting go. They told us how to follow the path using meditation and stillness. Millions of people in the West have followed, and although few, if any, have reached nirvana, many have found some degree of peace, happiness, and spiritual growth. So I do not mean to question the value or relevance of Buddhism in the modern world, or the importance of working on yourself in an effort to find happiness. Rather, I would like to suggest that the happiness hypothesis be extended, for now, into a yin-yang formulation. Happiness comes from within, and happiness comes from without. In Chapter 10, I'll suggest a further refinement of the hypothesis. To live both the yin and the yang, we need guidance. Buddha is history's most perceptive guide to the first half. He is a constant but gentle reminder of the yin of internal work. But I believe that the Western ideal of action, striving, and passionate attachment is not as misguided as Buddhism suggests. We just need some balance from the East and some specific guidance from modern psychology about what to strive for. Chapter 6. Love and Attachments. No one can live happily who has regard to himself alone and transforms everything into a question of his own utility. You must live for your neighbor if you would live for yourself. Seneca. No man is an island, entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. John Donne. In 1931, at the age of 4, my father was diagnosed with polio. He was immediately put into an isolation room at the local hospital in Brooklyn, New York. There was no cure and no vaccine for polio at that time, and city dwellers lived in fear of its spread. For several weeks, my father had no human contact, save for an occasional visit by a masked nurse. His mother came to see him every day, but that's all she could do. Waved to him and tried to talk to him through the glass pane on the door. My father remembers calling out to her, begging her to come in. It must have broken her heart, and one day she ignored the rules and went in. She was caught and sternly reprimanded. My father recovered with no paralysis, but this image has always stayed with me. A small boy alone in a room, gazing at his mother through a pane of glass. My father had the bad luck to be born at the confluence point of three big ideas. The first was germ theory, proposed in the 1840s by Ignaz Semmelweis and incorporated into hospitals and homes with gradually increasing ferocity over the next century. When they began to collect statistics from orphanages and foundling homes in the 1920s, pediatricians came to fear germs above all else. As far back as records went, they showed that most children dropped off at foundling homes died within 1 year. In 1915, a New York physician, Henry Chapin, reported to the American Pediatric Society that out of the 10 foundling homes he had examined, in all but one of them, all the children had died before their second birthday. As pediatricians came to grips with the deadly effects of institutions on young children, they reacted in a logical way by launching a crusade against germs. It became a priority in orphanages and hospitals to isolate children as much as possible in clean cubicles to prevent them from infecting each other. Beds were separated, dividers were placed between beds, nurses retreated behind masks and gloves, and mothers were scolded for violating quarantine. The other two big ideas were psychoanalysis and behaviorism. These two theories agreed on very little, but they both agreed that the infant's attachment to its mother is based on milk. Freud thought that the infant's libido, desire for pleasure, is first satisfied by the breast, and therefore the infant develops its first attachment, psychological need, to the breast. Only gradually does the child generalize that desire to the woman who owns the breast. The behaviorists didn't care about libido, but they, too, saw the breast as the first reinforcer, the first reward, milk, for the first behavior, sucking. The heart of behaviorism, if it had one, was conditioning, the idea that learning occurs when rewards are conditional upon behaviors. Unconditional love, holding, nuzzling and cuddling children for no reason, was seen as the surest way to make children lazy, spoiled, and weak. Freudians and behaviorists were united in their belief that highly affectionate mothering damages children, and that scientific principles could improve child-rearing. 3 years before my father entered the hospital, John Watson, the leading American behaviorist in the years before B.F. Skinner, published the bestseller Psychological Care of Infant and Child. Watson wrote of his dream that one day babies would be raised in baby farms, away from the corrupting influences of parents. But until that day arrived, parents were urged to use behaviorist techniques to rear strong children. Don't pick them up when they cry, don't cuddle or coddle them, just dole out benefits and punishments for each good and bad action. How could science have gotten it so wrong? How could doctors and psychologists not have seen that children need love as well as milk? This chapter is about that need, the need for other people, for touch, and for close relationships. No man, woman, or child is an island. Scientists have come a long way since John Watson, and there is now a much more humane science of love. The story of this science begins with orphans and rhesus monkeys and ends with a challenge to the dismal view of love held by many of the ancients, East and West. The heroes of this story are two psychologists who rejected the central tenets of their training, Harry Harlow and John Bowlby. These two men knew that something was missing in behaviorism and in psychoanalysis, respectively. Against great odds, they changed their fields. They humanized the treatment of children, and they made it possible for science to greatly improve upon the wisdom of the ancients. To have and to hold. Harry Harlow earned his Ph.D. in 1930 at Stanford, where he wrote his dissertation on the feeding behavior of baby rats. He took a job at the University of Wisconsin, where he found himself overwhelmed with teaching and undersupplied with research subjects, He had no lab space, no rats, no way to perform the experiments he was expected to publish. Out of desperation, Harlow took his students to the little zoo in Madison, Wisconsin, which had a small number of primates. Harlow and his first graduate student, Abe Maslow, couldn't run controlled experiments using so few animals. They were forced instead to observe, to keep their minds open, and to learn from species closely related to human beings. And one of the first things they saw was curiosity. The apes and monkeys liked to solve puzzles. The humans gave them tests to measure physical dexterity and intelligence, and would work at tasks for what seemed to be the sheer pleasure of it. Behaviorism, in contrast, said that animals will only do what they have been reinforced for doing. Harlow sensed he had found a flaw in behaviorism, but he couldn't prove it with anecdotes from the local zoo. He desperately wanted a lab in which to study primates, not rats, so he built one himself, literally built it in the shell of an abandoned building with the help of his students. In that makeshift lab, for the next 30 years, Harlow and his students infuriated behaviorists by demonstrating with ever more precision that monkeys are curious, intelligent creatures who like to figure things out. They follow the laws of reinforcement to some degree, as do humans, but there is much more going on in a monkey brain than the brain of a behaviorist could grasp. For example, giving monkeys raisins as a reward for each correct step in solving a puzzle, such as opening a mechanical latch with several moving parts, actually interferes with the solving because it distracts the monkeys. They enjoy the task for its own sake. As Harlow's lab grew, he faced perennial shortages of monkeys. They were hard to import, and when they arrived, they were often sick, bringing a stream of new infections into the lab. In 1955, Harlow conceived the bold idea of starting his own breeding colony of rhesus monkeys. Nobody had ever created a self-sustaining breeding colony of monkeys in the United States, let alone in the cold climate of Wisconsin, but Harlow was undeterred. He allowed his rhesus monkeys to mate, and then he took away the children within hours of their birth to save them from infections in a crowded lab. After much experimentation, he and his students created an artificial baby formula full of nutrients and antibiotics. They found the optimum pattern of feeding, light and dark cycles, and temperature. Each baby was raised in its own cage, safe from disease. Harlow had in a way realized Watson's dream of a baby farm, and the crop grew large and healthy looking. But when the farm-raised monkeys were brought into the company of others, they were stunned and unnerved. They never developed normal social or problem-solving skills, so they were useless for experiments. Harlow and his students were stumped. What had they forgotten? The clue was in plain sight, clutched in the monkeys' hands, until finally a grad student, Bill Mason, noticed it. Diapers. The cages in the baby hatchery were sometimes lined with old diapers to provide bedding material and protect the babies from the cold floor. The monkeys clung to the diapers, especially when they were afraid, and took them along when they were carried to new cages. Mason proposed a test to Harlow. Let's expose some young monkeys to a bundle of cloth and a bundle of wood. Let's see whether the monkeys just need to hold on to something, anything, or whether there's something special about the softness of the cloth. Harlow loved the idea, and as he thought it over, he saw an even grander question. Were the diapers really substitutes for mothers? Did the monkeys have an innate need to hold and be held, a need that was utterly starved in the baby farm? If so, how could he prove it? Harlow's proof became one of the most famous experiments in all of psychology. Harlow put the milk hypothesis to a direct test. He created two kinds of surrogate mother, each one a cylinder about the size of an adult female rhesus monkey, complete with a wooden head that had eyes and a mouth. One kind was made of wire mesh. The other was covered with a layer of foam and then a layer of soft terry cloth. Each of eight baby rhesus monkeys was raised alone in a cage with two surrogate mothers, one of each kind. For four of the monkeys, milk was delivered only from a tube coming through the chest of the wire mother. For the other four, the tube came through the chest of the cloth mother. If Freud and Watson were right that milk was the cause of attachment, the monkeys should attach to their milk givers. But that's not what happened. All the monkeys spent nearly all their time clinging to, climbing on, and pushing themselves into the soft folds of the cloth mother. Harlow's experiment is so elegant and so convincing that you don't need to see statistics to understand the results. You just need to see the famous photo, now included in every introductory psychology book, in which a baby monkey clings to the cloth mother with its hind legs while stretching over to feed from the tube protruding from the wire mother. Harlow argued that contact comfort is a basic need that young mammals have for physical contact with their mother. In the absence of a real mother, young mammals will seek out whatever feels most like a mother. Harlow chose the term carefully because the mother, even a cloth mother, provides comfort when it is most needed, and that comfort comes mostly from direct contact. Displays of familial love often move people to tears, and Deborah Blum's wonderful biography of Harlow, Love at Goon Park, is full of touching expressions of familial love. It is an uplifting story, ultimately, but along the way, it is full of sadness and unrequited love. The cover of the book, for example, shows a picture of a young rhesus monkey alone in a cage, gazing at its cloth mother through a pane of glass. Love Conquers Fear. John Bowlby's life followed an entirely different path from Harlow's, even though it led ultimately to the same discovery. Bowlby was an English aristocrat, raised by a nanny and sent to boarding school. He studied medicine and became a psychoanalyst. But during his early training years, he did some volunteer work that shaped the rest of his career. He worked at two homes for maladjusted children, many of whom had no real contact with their parents. Some were aloof and uncommunicative, others were hopelessly clingy, following him around anxiously if he paid the slightest attention to them. After serving in World War II, Bowlby returned to England to run the children's clinic in a hospital. He began to do research on how separation from parents affects children. Europe at the time had just experienced more parent-child separations than had any place in all of human history. The war had created vast numbers of orphans, refugees, and children sent away to the countryside for their own safety. The new World Health Organization commissioned Bowlby to write a report on the best way to deal with these children. Bowlby toured hospitals and orphanages, and his report, published in 1951, was a passionate argument against prevailing notions that separation and isolation are harmless, and that biological needs such as nutrition are paramount. Children need love to develop properly, he argued. Children need mothers. Throughout the 1950s, Bowlby developed his ideas and weathered the scorn of psychoanalysts such as Anna Freud and Melanie Klein, whose theories about libido and breasts he contradicted. He had the good luck to meet a leading ethologist of the day, Robert Hind, who taught him about new research on animal behavior. Conrad Lorenz, for example, had demonstrated that ducklings, 10 to 12 hours after they hatch, will lock onto whatever duck-sized thing moves around in their environment and then follow it around for months. In nature, this thing is always mom. But in Lorenz's demonstrations, anything he moved around worked, even his own boots, with him in them. This visual imprinting mechanism is quite different from what happens in people, but once Bowlby began to think about how evolution creates mechanisms to make sure that mothers and children stay together, the way was open for an entirely new approach to human parent-child relationships. There's no need to derive the bond from milk, reinforcement, libido, or anything else. Rather, the attachment of mother and child is so enormously important for the survival of the child that a dedicated system is built into mother and child in all species that rely on maternal care. As Bowlby began to pay more attention to animal behavior, he saw many similarities between the behaviors of baby monkeys and baby humans. Clinging, sucking, crying when left behind, following whenever possible. All these behaviors functioned in other primates to keep the child close to mom, and all were visible in human children, even the pick-me-up signal of upstretched arms. In 1957, Hind learned about Harlow's not-yet-published cloth mother studies and told Bowlby, who wrote to Harlow and later visited him in Wisconsin. The two men became great allies and supporters of each other. Bowlby, the great theorist, created the framework that has unified most subsequent research on parent-child relations, and Harlow, the great experimentalist, provided the first irrefutable lab demonstrations of the theory. Bowlby's grand synthesis is called attachment theory. It borrows from the science of cybernetics, the study of how mechanical and biological systems can regulate themselves to achieve preset goals while the environment around and inside them changes. Bowlby's first metaphor was the simplest cybernetic system of all, a thermostat that turns on a heater when the temperature drops below a set point. Attachment theory begins with the idea that two basic goals guide children's behavior, safety and exploration. A child who stays safe survives. A child who explores and plays develops the skills and intelligence needed for adult life. This is why all mammal babies play, and the larger their frontal cortex, the more they need to play. These two needs are often opposed, however, so they are regulated by a kind of thermostat that monitors the level of ambient safety. When this safety level is adequate, the child plays and explores. But as soon as it drops too low, it's as though a switch were thrown, and suddenly safety needs become paramount. The child stops playing and moves toward mom. If mom is unreachable, the child cries, and with increasing desperation. When mom returns, the child seeks touch or some other reassurance before the system can reset and play can resume. This is an instance of the design principle I discussed in Chapter 2. Opposing systems push against each other to reach a balance point. Fathers make perfectly good attachment figures, but Bowlby focused on mother-child attachments, which usually get off to a faster start. If you want to see the system in action, just try engaging a 2-year-old in play. If you go to a friend's house and meet her child for the first time, it should take only a minute. The child feels secure in his familiar surroundings, and his mother functions as what Bowlby called a secure base, an attachment figure whose presence guarantees safety, turns off fear, and thereby enables the explorations that lead to healthy development. But if your friend brings her son over to your house for the first time, it will take longer. You'll probably have to walk around your friend just to find the little head hiding behind her thighs. And then, if you succeed in starting a game, making faces at him to make him laugh perhaps, just watch what happens when his mother goes to the kitchen to get a glass of water. The thermostat clicks, the game ends, and your play partner scampers off to the kitchen too. Harlow had shown all the same behavior in monkeys. Young monkeys placed with their cloth mother in the center of an open room full of toys eventually climbed down from mom to explore, but they returned often to touch her and reconnect. If the cloth mother was removed from the room, all play stopped and frantic screaming ensued. When children are separated from their attachment figures for a long time, as in a hospital stay, they quickly descend into passivity and despair. When they are denied a stable and enduring attachment relationship, raised, for example, by a succession of foster parents or nurses, they are likely to be damaged for life, Bowlby said. They might become the aloof loners or hopeless clingers that Bowlby had seen in his volunteer work. Bowlby's theory directly contradicted Watson as well as the Freuds, Sigmund and Anna. If you want your children to grow up to be healthy and independent, you should hold them, hug them, cuddle them, and love them. Give them a secure base and they will explore and then conquer the world on their own. The power of love over fear was well expressed in the New Testament. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear. 1 John chapter 4, verse 18. The proof is in the parting. If you're going to contradict the prevailing wisdom of your day, you'd better have darn good evidence. Harlow's studies were darn good, but skeptics claimed they didn't apply to people. Bowlby needed more proof, and he got it from a Canadian woman who happened to answer an ad he placed for a research assistant in 1950. Mary Ainsworth, who had moved to London with her husband, spent 3 years working with Bowlby on his early studies of hospitalized children. When her husband took an academic job in Uganda,